Well, it's almost that magical time of year when little kiddies get presents and adults, well, sometimes adults get presents too. And we've got a couple of recommendations for stocking stuffers this year. A couple of books that, while not strictly speaking constitutional in nature, have a strong nexus to American history, American political history, and even a little bit to European history. We think you'll enjoy them. The first is called The Wilson Deception. How's that for a cool title? And the other one, Black Earth. One of them is pure fun, the other one pure serious, but both of them are worthwhile. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's about a couple of really cool books you might like.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
David O. Stewart is an old buddy of mine. He's written a lot of history books, at least one book about James Madison, and he's actually got a series of novels out that he's about halfway through. The first of them was called The Lincoln Deception. The one we're going to talk about today is set a little bit later in time. It's called The Wilson Deception. And before today is over, you're going to find out about the third book in the series, which is going to come out early next year. So stay tuned. In fact, we're going to talk to David Stewart very shortly here. We're also going to speak to a fellow I've only met over the telephone. His name is Tim Snyder. And Tim Snyder is a historian from Yale. And he's also written a book that I think you might find very interesting. This one's called Black Earth. And that's a reference to the Earth of Ukraine. And Tim's focus is the Holocaust as it unfolded in Ukraine, where there were some very special and very tragic aspects to it. But first, let's hear from David O. Stewart all about The Wilson Deception.
I'm David Stewart, and I write books. I've been writing historical narratives about American history for a number of years, and I've started writing historical fiction also, often about American history.
What prompted you to move from historical books, straight history, into historical fiction?
Well, it really was one story that I just wanted to tell, and that was in my first novel, which was a fact-based report that a fellow who led the prosecution of John Wilkes Booth co-conspirators claimed that he had learned something during that trial of Booth's co-conspirators that was so incendiary it would have destroyed the Republic if he had ever revealed it. And that was just so intriguing that I wanted to write about it, but the guy then died and never told the secret. So,
oh, man.
Yeah, so I had to make it up. I mean, what was I to do? And that was a lot of fun, and it turned out the publisher who wanted to publish it wanted a series. They like series. So he said, this is a series, right? And I said, well, yeah, of course. And so this most recent one that I've done is takes my same protagonists and plops them down 19 years later at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919.
Well, speaking as someone who, and I must apologize, did not read your first novel. I know it's a terrible, terrible omission on my part, and I hate to admit it.
You have an empty gray existence.
I knew it's a terrible thing, but I did read this novel, which is called, of course, The Wilson Deception, and I will say that it works even as a standalone novel. And
that's
so,
good to hear.
Yeah, I know that's a challenge for anybody who's writing a series of books. But you do a good job of making references to the earlier novel and bringing the reader into it. But that's our focus today, of course, is The Wilson Deception, which has just been published, hasn't it?
It has.
And, of course, you've sold 1.5 million copies already, I'm sure?
Who can keep track?
Well, I do know from our earlier conversations that you have been out doing book tours and doing things of that sort, and I understand that those have been going swimmingly.
Yeah, it's been great. I do enjoy getting out and talking to folks and hearing what they think about the historical stuff I write about. And, I've been in some interesting places, so I like that.
Let's talk about that a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, please, because, of course, the cliche is, the trope is that writers don't like book tours, and that they're horribly repetitive and miserable, and the travel is horrible and burdensome and all the rest of it. But I sense from our conversations that you actually kind of like this, kind of liking your interactions with readers.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a trial lawyer, so I'm a ham bone at heart, and I like sort of getting up and talking to people, and I find it a great discipline because you actually have to say in a relatively short period of time what the book is about, and that is a great thing to an exercise to go through, and you know, I do like talking to folks and hearing from them. It is. You know, most recently I did 8 days on the road, and it does get old. Mm-hmm. You know, you're trying to get your laundry done, and it's hard to get decent food. Mm-hmm. Or I don't mean decent, but, you know, it all gets a little much. but, you know, I'm not about to complain about it. And I will acknowledge I am not doing the sort of 27-day, 42-city tours that perhaps other writers are doing. Mm-hmm. So, that may account for why it doesn't bother me so much.
I see. Well, what is the book about? The Wilson Deception. What a good title. What is this about?
It's about the Paris Peace Conference at the end of World War I, which, you know, that's the war that was supposed to be the war to end all wars. And
that worked out pretty well, didn't it?
Yeah, the Peace Conference has been called the Peace to End All Peace, which... you know, when you look at it, it's not a surprise. Mm-hmm. It was a meeting only of the winners. So, you know, you don't half the relevant parties are not there. And, you know, it's been a terrible war, just a brutal, horrible experience, global war for the first time on such a massive scale, tens of millions killed. And, you know, the winners got greedy, you know, and they weren't thinking so much about the good of the world, but they were trying to get themselves reelected. And that meant they had to walk away with something delicious that they had won at the sacrifice of so many hundreds of thousands of their citizens. So it got pretty grimy, and it was a wonderful tension because Woodrow Wilson, who's the book is named after, tried to basically reorient everything and make it an idealistic cause. And that didn't succeed, and it created a real sense of hypocrisy about the whole thing. And so it's a fascinating moment to explore. I genuinely think that we don't pay attention to the fact that Woodrow Wilson really changed the way the world thinks about diplomacy and international affairs in this time frame by basically changing the vocabulary. You could no longer go to war because you wanted to annex a province. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't going to cut it. It was just too awful that you would be slaughtering people for land. And that might actually be what you're after, but you couldn't say it anymore. You know, mm-hmm. Putin, when he grabs Crimea, he's creating freedom for the Russian speakers there. And, you know, he's got to be in service of some great ideal. And that's actually what Wilson, I think, imposed on the world. And I can't swear we're better for it, but we certainly are different.
We certainly are. In fact, I'll hearken back to your first book and the war that your first book was set in. And, of course, you know, Lincoln brought emancipation, the end of slavery, as a war aim for the Union cause late to the game. I mean, you know, originally it was about preserving the Union, and only later did it become about ending slavery. And in much the same fashion, or in a similar fashion, so I suppose, Wilson tried to impose this idealistic goal, evolving from our interest in freedom of the seas and, you know, freedom from aggression. Into this great crusade, the 14 points and all of that, but it didn't really work out too well, did it?
Not in the event. You know, it is an American weakness. We love to go to war to make people better, mm-hmm. to bring them democracy and freedom. You know, the Spanish-American War, we claim that. We're still claiming it. And it turns out war is a pretty tricky way to do that. You know, killing people to make them better is tough.
Destroying the village to save the village comes to mind, but we get ahead of ourselves. All right. So at any rate, here we are. It's the Paris Peace Talks, which, of course, begin in, I think it was early 1919, wasn't it?
Yes, they convened formally in early January.
Right, of course. The armistice was the 11th of November of 1918, but that was only an armistice. An armistice, you know, literally translated simply means, you know, a cessation of actual violent hostilities. But as you point out, then now we have to actually have a peace conference and we have to come up with a treaty. And so the protagonists, at least those on the victorious side, gather in Paris, at Versailles. And your novel picks up at that point. So tell me a little bit more about it.
Well, the challenge for all of this is to take my heroes who come from the first book, mm-hmm. and one is a doctor who hails from Eastern Ohio, and the other is this sort of complex African-American fellow who was a baseball player back when the professional leagues were integrated in the 1870s and 1880s. He got driven out of baseball, and he's what was known then as a race man. He's very self-righteous about and angry about the discrimination he suffers every day. Mm-hmm. And they are thrown together in the first book, The Lincoln Deception. And now it's 19 years later, and I need to bring them together in this remarkable international stage. And, you know, a threshold question was, you know, so would they have been in touch with each other for the intervening period? And I concluded not, that it was just too tricky for a white man and a black man to be good friends in the first 20 years of the 20th century. I just thought it would be unrealistic.
Yeah, that period is often identified as the lowest point, the nadir of race relations in this country, when we were sort of reacting to the end of slavery and when African Americans were trying to find their place in society. And a lot of white people were not very happy about this. So I think that was probably a reasonable artistic decision on your side and on your part.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, these two guys sort of are thrown together. They work as partners, but they get under each other's skin, which I think, again, they would. You know, they're really from such different worlds. So the doctor is in Paris because he's joined the army in his late middle age and is treating the troops in dealing with the hideous war wounds and the Spanish flu epidemic that had struck in Europe and actually around the world. And the African-American fellow comes to Paris both because there is a big event for black people. It's the Pan-African Congress, the second one ever, which is scheduled to run with the peace conference. But he's also there because his son has been a soldier with the American Expeditionary Force and is facing a terrible challenge because he's been accused of desertion. And the way we treated our black soldiers during World War I was pretty miserable. Mm-hmm. And this sort of mistreatment was not unheard of. So it was
indeed,
an opportunity.
The father feels pretty – I read the book and had a great time reading it, by the way. But the father had encouraged the son to volunteer for the First World War, because, you know, as many African Americans felt at that time, they wanted to show that they were capable, that they were patriotic, and that they should be treated as equals. And of course, there was a great deal of guilt that went with that.
Yeah, our black citizens repeatedly, in our wars, beginning with the Revolution, mm-hmm. Went to war thinking that it would earn them respect. And, you know, while the bullets were flying, it did. But as soon as the bullets stopped flying, white people managed to forget it.
And they certainly did. And it's part of a larger story. We managed to forget the contributions of our veterans pretty consistently, going back all the way to the Revolution, which is a terrible, terrible thing. And certainly our minority veterans in particular. So, yeah, that was very realistic treatment of that, I thought.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the middle of a fascinating discussion with my buddy David O. Stuart, who's a lawyer, who's a historian, who also is a novelist, and we're speaking about his most recent novel, The Wilson Deception, that's all wrapped up in the Wilson administration and Versailles and all that really cool stuff. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz. We'll finish our discussion with David, and then we'll talk about even another book. This is just a very bookish sort of episode, so stick around. Now it's time for me and my buddy John Alger, the president of James Madison University, to share a constitutional quiz with you.
All right, who do we got next?
I'm Ned Sieverts, and I'm a student here.
Ned! Where are you from, Ned?
I'm from Arlington, Virginia, so just Arlington? Outside the D.C. Right. area.
Just down the road, so you can go home on the weekends and do laundry.
No, I'm a good student.
Tremendous. Okay, well, Ned, what are you majoring in?
Political science.
Okay, well, that sounds like right up your alley then. Yeah. Quiz prez, do we have a question for Ned?
We do. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. The original purpose of the Philadelphia Convention was to A, recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation, B, write a new constitution, C, abolish the Articles of Confederation, or D, choose the first president.
Hey, come on now. Who's blurting out answers back there? This is just like Wheel of Fortune, okay?
Right.
Shh! Stop it. Don't solve the puzzles. I'm not saying that was the right answer. I'm saying that Rex has a very big mouth back there. Okay.
Well, since Professor Pete is my professor that I just came from class from, I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with A. What was A again?
Recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation.
And that was the one I was considering, but Pete secured my answer.
Oh, right.
This is the phone-a-friend concept.
Yeah. Is that the phone-a-friend concept? Yeah. Well, did he get it right?
And the correct answer is A, recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation.
Now, there's a little bit more to that one as well. Now, the Articles of Confederation required, get this now, I think it was Article 6 of the Articles of Confederation required that for any significant action, there had to be unanimous consent of the states, right? Now, again, the pizza analogy, if you had 13 friends over, they're going to be unanimous in anything. No, that was one of the real weaknesses of the Articles. So people realized that even though that was the original way they sold this convention, that we need to fix the Articles, especially with regard to the regulation of commerce, which was a huge issue in the 1780s, they sold it that way, but as soon as they got there, Madison basically pulled out the Virginia plan, and implicit in that was, guys, we just got to throw it all out and start from scratch. And this was practically seditious. I mean, these guys were ultra-virus. That's a fancy legal term for they were going way beyond what many of their state assemblies had authorized. And in fact, I think it was Patterson, when he showed up from New Jersey, he was like, what are you people doing? And he proposed a complete alternate plan that basically went back to the Articles. And it was only because the convention adopted a rule of secrecy, and it was only because they observed it, that people like Patrick Henry were sort of blindsided. If he'd known what was going on there and shown up, he would have thrown a wrench into this whole thing. So that was a huge issue, huge issue.
Yeah, we might just mention too, it's hard for us, to conceive of it today, but there was still an awful lot of loyalty to the individual states, much more than a sense of being united as a country, right? And a lot of it had to do with the distances, the difficulties of travel and communication at the time. So there was much more isolation of these individual states from one another. And frankly, they didn't necessarily trust one another in terms of having each other's best interests. So It was a really complicated time, and all the more remarkable when we see what came out of it.
When you think of the 1780s and the level of cooperation between the various states, think of football rivalries, right? How much do state football teams at various state institutions like each other? They don't even like each other within the same state. And that's why we basically needed to throw out that system and start afresh. Kudos to James Madison. He recognized that. All righty. Thank you, Quiz Prez.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about books. We're talking about books that have some connection to constitutional history, certainly the one we're talking about now by my buddy David O. Stewart, a book called The Wilson Deception. It has a great deal to do with presidential politics back in the second Wilson administration, and specifically has to do with the negotiations, the Byzantine negotiations surrounding the Treaty of Versailles. And David's created some fictional characters, but he's placed them squarely in the middle of all of that intrigue.
So, you know, they're in Paris and they get entangled with some of the key players. Both because it turns out two of the three major negotiators, President Wilson and Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, have terrible medical emergencies, and luckily one of our characters is a doctor and he can help.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well. In fact, lucky. Speaking of the creative process, I mean, you already created this character in the previous book. What was the doctor's name again?
Jamie Fraser.
Fraser. Dr. Fraser, I mean, he was there. I mean, he was a doctor already. And speaking of the creative process, that must have been kind of cool for you as you were thinking, you know, what would happen here. Oh, wait a second. Both Wilson and Clemenceau were old guys and who had medical problems, and so this guy could help.
Yeah, I knew it about Wilson. When I started the book, I actually didn't know about Clemenceau's crisis.
And everybody knows about Wilson. Wilson basically started going, he started having strokes.
He really started to fall apart.
He started to fall apart, and this was during that part, and you do a very good job of painting that portrait. But Clemenceau was actually prompted very differently. It was an injury.
Yeah, he got shot.
There's that, yeah.
It's kind of amazing. I'm often embarrassed by what I don't know, but you got to fess up to it. 2 months into the conference, you know, some nutty anarchist gunned him down in the street.
Ouch.
And, you know, he was 78 years old. Clemenceau was 78 years old, and, you know, he not only recovered, they never took the bullet out, and you know he lived another 10 years. He was a pretty tough old buzzard.
He was. He kind of reminds me of Teddy Roosevelt.
The story is very similar, yes, to when Teddy Roosevelt was shot and like then finished his speech. Which is unbelievable.
You gotta love that, absolutely. Yeah. So what did they call Clemenceau? Was it the tiger? Was
that the tiger?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. So he was a tough old bird. Okay, so that's just a wonderful opportunity. I mean, you've got two of the three world leaders that are there, and the third being, was it Lloyd George?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
the British Prime Minister.
Yeah.
And, you know, two of the three major allied leaders are, you know, terrible medical situations, and so your Dr. Fraser, you know, gets to step into the breach.
It was just so lucky he was there. I've now written a third, which will in the series, which will come out next year. And
no way, already.
No way, but
you must work all the time.
Well, I've heard that. But it is. I've developed this sort of mantra for myself, which is history will provide. Mm-hmm. Whenever I hit a sort of problem, and fiction writers repeatedly have this problem, which is what next? You know, what happens next? I often will just go read some more history, and I'll find something that actually I can work with and tie in. So that makes the historical fiction a lot of fun for me.
Oh, it is a lot of fun. Well, we're not going to give away the end here, but we won't. I mean, we want people to go out and enjoy it for themselves, and I wouldn't want to spoil it for anyone, but now you've set it up. I mean, you got Fraser. And he's there because he's part of the American Expeditionary Force, and he's right in the middle of everything. And then your African-American protagonist, what's his name again?
Speed Cook.
Speed Cook. Now, Cook actually shows up. He had to get on a tramp steamer, basically, and, you know, cross the Atlantic Ocean. So he's from a very different socioeconomic background, but he makes his way there, and he's trying to free his son. And then the two of them get involved in all kinds of adventures. And again, I'm not going to give anything away, but I'll simply say that I was very, very impressed and very gratified to see that the Dulles brothers, Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, who later would play such enormous roles in American foreign policy as respectively the head of the CIA and the head of the State Department in the 1950s, they made their appearances and were very much wrapped up in this. In fact, tell me a little bit about those guys, the Dulles brothers and their uncle, who had been the Secretary of State before them. I mean, was that something you knew about beforehand, or was that something that came up in your research?
No, it came up in the research. Yeah, mm-hmm. History will provide.
right.
And it is hard to believe that, you know, this is true. And, I often say if I came up with these characters, people would say that that's ridiculous. They mm-hmm. wouldn't believe it. But Alan Dulles was a 25-year-old ex-spook. He had been a spy in Switzerland during the war, obviously as a very young man, running agents into Austria-Hungary. Mm-hmm. And John Foster was there. He was practicing law, and he was there as leading the analysis of the German reparations, what funds we were going to demand that the Germans repay to mm-hmm. make the victors whole. And you know, they were able to rise so quickly as young men to high position because, happily enough for them, their uncle was Secretary of State.
Nice connection to have.
It's always good to have a cabinet member in the family.
Exactly, and they had those fancy Ivy League connections.
And
exactly.
So Robert Lansing was the fellow's name, or they called him Uncle Bert. Mm-hmm. And he was totally on the outs with Wilson at this time. He had told Wilson not to go to Paris and basically told Wilson a number of things Wilson didn't like. And Wilson, he didn't get along with people too well, certainly people who tried to tell him what to do. So he really banished Lansing, where he was very comfortable with these young men who, of course, weren't telling him what to do, but were doing what he asked them to. And particularly Alan Dulles at 25 ended up at the end of the conference as really his closest aide. So mm-hmm. you have an ex-spy who's Wilson's closest aide. So he then becomes a wonderful pivot point for a number of elements of the story, including the dilemma of how to help out our poor black soldier who is getting railroaded, and as well as some, you know, global issues of.
But not altruistically. What I thought was very, very good in your treatment of this was that, you know, though he certainly had a certain degree of interest in Speed Cook's son, Alan Dulles was very much a realist and a calculator, and he was willing to do things to a point, but only if it was going to benefit him. And in fact, I think you captured very well my understanding of the disparate personalities of those two. Alan Dulles was the adventurer, and he was the charmer, and he was the guy who got things done. And Foster Dulles was the guy who seems to have spent his entire adult life constipated.
I've seen very few photographs of him where he doesn't look like his stomach hurts.
Exactly right, and I feel bad for him, but I mean, apparently that's the way he was. And so that was fascinating too, but we're getting perilously close to giving away the plot, and I'm not going to do that, but I'll simply say it involves airplanes and involves adventure. It involves all kinds of really cool stuff, and now I'm going to ask you to do something that's perilous. I'm going to ask you to tell me what's the basic premise of the third book in this series.
Well, having written it, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's called The Babe Ruth Deception.
The Babe Ruth Deception. So this is in the 1920s or is it 30s?
It's just a year later. I learned my lesson.
You did 19 years. Gave up some opportunities there.
You jumped 19 years. You miss out on some stuff. So
yeah.
We only went 1 year. Also, you know, my lead characters got a good bit older, so that the derring do that they are capable of doing becomes a bit less daring.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, we have the younger man who can assist with that. But it's just a year later. It's 1920. It's the first year of Prohibition, and they're back in New York. There are, you know, anarchists and terrorists running around New York. There is obviously bootlegging at a major level, and you have Babe Ruth's first season with the Yankees when he really remakes baseball. He hits 59 home runs. I think he hits more home runs than eight whole teams hit. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us who know about Babe Ruth sort of see him in these old photos as this, you know, beer gut guy who was sort of prancing around the bases and looking a little silly. And I was lucky. There is he made a silent movie in 1920, which was a bomb. But we have this wonderful hour-long record of what he looked like and how he moved. And he was an Adonis, which is not a shock. I mean, he set all the records in baseball for, you know, decades. But as a physical character, he was a genetic freak. I mean, he was amazing. And that was an exciting thing to write about.
Very exciting. But before we go on further, you're screwing up your title. You should simply be the Ruth Deception, not the Babe Ruth Deception.
Well, you know,
you've got an extra syllable in there. It just doesn't work.
Well, Babe Ruth, like Wilson, like Lincoln.
No. You and your agent need to get down. It's got to be the Ruth Deception.
Somebody might think it's a book about a woman named Ruth. I mean,
they might think that, but no. I mean, you know, so what? I mean, so you get a few biblical scholars in there, but it doesn't matter. You'll bring them into the fold.
Well, we'll take your opinion under advisement.
Well, you're the best-selling author, so I'm going to leave that to you. But that's really exciting. But I do have a bigger question. That is, wait a second. I mean, Lincoln, Wilson, both presidents. Babe Ruth, important, but not a president.
Yeah, but he's really cool.
Shouldn't it be the Harding Deception?
Well, you know, if you don't want to sell any books, it could be. You know, some of these things, and you know, I wanted to write a story that was not about, world events. That was about baseball. I thought that'd be a great treat. And I like having the freedom, if I'm going to do any more of these, which is undecided, not to feel like it's got to be a president who's facing a crisis. This way I can sort of. And there's only so many times you can throw your non-presidential characters in the room with the president. So I think having this additional freedom to use other moments in history is going to work for me.
Well, I'll agree. I think the history of early baseball is fascinating. I recall vividly as a child reading a marvelous children's biography of Babe Ruth. Fascinating character. I hope that you will work in to the story his affinity for soda pop and hot dogs at some point. and that it will be just as compelling in its own way as these earlier ones. But then, of course, now I've already got a title for the fourth book, and this, and it's got to be the FDR Deception. You've got to go back to the presidential stuff.
I think there's much you could work with FDR. That's as far as I can go.
Indeed it is. All right. Well, David Stewart, author of the Wilson Deception, which is now in bookstores, thank you very much for sharing this fascinating story with us, and I encourage everyone to go out and buy 15 copies of your book.
That's a terrific idea. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished a discussion with my buddy David O. Stewart all about his fascinating new novel about the Wilson administration called The Wilson Deception. After the break, we're going to talk with another author. His name is Tim Snyder, about his book. Now, his book is a bit more serious. It's called Black Earth, and it's all about the Holocaust. Stay tuned.
Apart from Dolly, Montpelier is witness to a long line of women who pushed the boundaries normally prescribed to women in their time. Madison's grandmother Frances, founding mother of Montpelier, took charge after her husband's untimely death, and as a widow inserted a clause into a land grant settlement, granting herself ownership of the property for life. Nellie, Madison's mother, was his solid connection to the past. She provided another emotional pull for James, vis-a-vis Dolly, and her dedication to education meant that Madison had the best formal education of any of the major founding fathers. And Marion DuPont Scott, born in a time when her intellect was not considered sufficient to cast a vote, when a woman riding a horse was considered some kind of sexually provocative act, could claim to have chosen her own path, and we can thank her for returning James Madison's home back to the country. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today we're talking about a couple of really interesting books. And the one we're going to talk about for the remainder of the hour is by a fellow named Tim Snyder. He teaches at a place you may have heard of called Yale University. And his book is called Black Earth. And as we'll be hearing, it's all about a sad subject, the Holocaust, in a very specific place called Ukraine.
I'm Tim Snyder, and I'm a historian.
Well, that's cool. Where are you a historian?
I have the pleasure and the good fortune of teaching students at Yale University, but the where is not so simple, because to write what I write, I have to spend a lot of time in Europe. So mm-hmm. I am a historian in places like Russia or Belarus or Ukraine or Austria or Poland, although this is where I teach.
What a concept, a historian who actually goes to the sites that he's writing about. That's very good. Of course, we're talking to you today about your most recent work called Black Earth. Could you give us the full title of your book and tell us a little bit about it?
The title of the book is Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. It's an interpretive history of the Holocaust. That is, it's not about memory. It's not about pictures. It's not about what we think we know. It's about trying to understand the causes of the mass murder of millions of European Jews. And the reason for the subtitle is this: if you get the history right, if you understand the history in terms of causes and effects, then the significance for the present immediately becomes clear.
Oh, we'll talk about that too. I was intrigued, of course, by this as soon as I heard about it, because I think most Holocaust histories I've read, most discussions I've overheard, tend to see it as a unique event that was essentially the brainchild of one person who was mad and evil and who caused all of this stuff, and they focus pretty much exclusively on Hitler and anti-Semitism, and perhaps a bit more broadly on its origins within German society. But you look beyond that, don't you?
I think, you know, in your question, you very precisely hit upon three different problems of the way we think about the Holocaust. The first is the notion of uniqueness. The idea of uniqueness trivializes the Holocaust, because every historical event is unique, as every historian will tell you. Our conversation is unique. There will never be another conversation exactly like it. What is important about the Holocaust is that it was unprecedented. There was never an event like it. But once we start using that vocabulary, once we go into that storehouse of words, we realize something else. Something which is unprecedented can be a precedent, which the Holocaust is. And that's another reason why we have to get away from the uniqueness idea. Mm-hmm. The word uniqueness provides a psychological comfort, because something that's unique can't happen again. By definition, it can only happen once, whereas things like the Holocaust can happen again, and indeed things which resemble it have already happened again. The second thing is anti-Semitism. It's right, of course, to remember Hitler's anti-Semitism, but we don't see how radical it was. We don't see that it could appeal to people, because it provided a kind of shorthand to globalization. It provided a way to make sense of a planet which was seemed otherwise too complex, too threatening, too anxiety-producing. So we wrong when we think of Hitler, who was just someone who was so anti-Semitic that he was crazy. In a way, it's the other way around. His anti-Semitism was a kind of key which helped him to make the world make sense, unfortunately not just for himself but for many other people as well. And the third thing is one person. Of course, Hitler was, I think, a necessary precondition for the Holocaust, but there were quite literally hundreds of thousands of people who took direct part in the event. And since the entire thing took place beyond Germany, we can't limit ourselves to just discussing one German leader or even the whole German population. German Jews were a very, very small minority of the victims. Roughly half of them survived. 97% of the people killed in the Holocaust lived beyond the boundaries of Germany. So we need a history which takes into account all of Europe, not just the Jews, but also their neighbors, not just in Germany, but in the places where Jews actually lived in large numbers.
What have you learned? What does your research show to you are some of the causes of the Holocaust that people are not focused upon?
One way to start is by thinking of what we take for granted. Because in general, what we take for granted about history is the thing which is comfortable for us today. Mm-hmm. And so historians generally have to start off their work by working against what we remember, because we tend to remember what works for us today as opposed to what actually happened. So in the U.S., whether we're on the right, whether we're on the left, we tend to think the problem with the Holocaust was that there was too much state, that the German state was too strong, too authoritarian. It classified its citizens. It bureaucratized them to death. That is exactly what did not happen. That simply didn't happen. The German bureaucracy was unable to kill Jews on German territory. In fact, that was a problem that Hitler ran into, that so long as Jews were subject to even a very flawed and discriminatory bureaucratic administration and legal system, it was extremely hard to eradicate them. And so what Germans actually learned, or what Nazis actually learned with time, was that the way to kill Jews was to destroy states. The Holocaust begins not in Germany. The Holocaust begins when German power begins to destroy neighboring states. Austria in March of 1938, Czechoslovakia in the autumn of 1938, the spring of 1939, Poland in the fall of 1939, and then the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941. As German power moves beyond Germany, Jews are increasingly threatened. Each time the steps taken against Jews are more radical, each time the anarchy is deeper, each time the experimentation is more thorough, and new ways are found, not just to discriminate against Jews as in Germany, but actually to murder them. So the major argument of the book is that it's not so much a big state which is dangerous. It's a state which is taken over by people who have a particular ideology, in this case a racial ideology, which seems to authorize destroying other people's states and bringing a special kind of anarchy to those places.
If we could elaborate on that a little bit and put her in broader context, this is nothing new for the Germans and the Poles. In fact, there had been several partitions of Poland preceding 1941, 1939, and certainly during more than one of those, there had been attempts to essentially erase the Polish state.
That's a really, really interesting question, because it shows us continuity, but it also gives us an opportunity to talk about change. You're absolutely right that the zone between Germany and Russia has been a zone of, let's call it inconsistent statehood. So the old Polish state was partitioned out of existence, as you say, in the late 18th century mm-hmm. by Prussia, the Habsburg monarchy, and the Russian Empire. But something interesting happens by the 20th century, and that's this. When Poland was partitioned out of existence, those other empires didn't say these territories that we are taking in are barbarous lands inhabited by subhumans. They incorporated them to their own territories. Now, they may have incorporated them in ways which would seem to us to be unjust. As empires, they no doubt treated their subjects in ways which we would find unfair. But nevertheless, essentially what they did was they extended their own practices, their own normal constitutional, if you like, practices to these people, to these new subjects. In 1939, something very special happens. In 1939, when Germany invades Poland, the idea isn't to treat this Polish territory as a normal country which is going to be just brought under German power. Instead, the idea is to treat it as a kind of colony, the way that Europeans had treated African colonies, for example, where there was no state, there were no laws, and therefore anything is possible. So the Germany applies to Poland a very special doctrine, which is that they are moving into a territory where there has never been rule of law and where the people are not subject to any legal protection. And therefore what's happening in Poland, and they say this explicitly, is not an occupation, because there is literally nothing to be occupied. So what's happened is that a European power is applying to another European territory the same kinds of mindsets and the same kinds of practices which were invented in the imperial moment of the 19th century. And this has consequences because it means that everyone is stripped immediately of the normal protections of law and not given the protections of law that would come from the new country, which would come from Germany. This creates the space for all sorts of things to happen which wouldn't be possible in an old-fashioned partition or in a traditional military occupation.
Well, I'd love to explore that further, but there are a couple of other major points you make, that a lot of this sprang from Hitler's reaction to what he perceived as an ecological problem. Could we explore that a little bit as well?
Yeah, thank you. You've got your mind around the two big arguments of the book. I mean, the two big arguments are that a Holocaust can happen only where traditional political institutions, even imperfect ones, are violently removed, and that a Holocaust can happen only in a special kind of moment, an artificially produced moment of ecological panic. And to explain what this means, we have to take a step back and think about what the world was like in the 1930s. When we look at the 1930s, when we look at film reels, what we notice are, you know, the automobiles, perhaps the tanks, we see the swastika flags. What we see is modern. But what we don't notice is the 1930s, even in a developed country like Germany, was still a time when access to resources was uncertain. The German people were going through a Great Depression. The German economy was dependent upon international markets for food and other commodities. And all adult Germans could remember that their country was blockaded by Great Britain during and indeed after the First World War. This meant that food was in politics in a way which is hard for us to understand, because our generations, the post-war generations, are the only generations in history for whom food has not actually been an issue in politics. So the thing which distinguishes us from Germans in the 1930s, I think, is not so much that we've learned a lot. I don't actually believe we've learned a lot morally or politically. I'm not convinced of that at all. The thing which distinguishes us from them is that we don't worry about food.
We worry about an overabundance of it. We're worried about obesity.
Exactly. That's so true. So, I mean, when we say calorie, we're thinking of something we have to avoid. Mm-hmm. When a German planner in 1935 said calorie, he meant a unit of energy of which there were too few and which they were trying to make sure enough of got to animals and men and women who were doing the labor of the economy. So in that way, it was a different world. Anxieties about food were real. And what Hitler did was, he made a very intelligent, although quite, I think, satanic argument. He said that your anxieties about food are justified. In fact, the entire world is just one unfolding catastrophe. There's nothing going on in the world except an endless struggle for resources. And if you have another thought, if you think that maybe Christian mercy is right, or socialism is justified, or even if you believe in the legalism of capitalism and its contracts, well then, says Hitler, you've been fooled by Jews. All of those things, all those universal ideas, Christianity, socialism, capitalism, doesn't matter, they're all Jewish inventions to distract you from the basic truth that the only reality is the anxiety that you feel, the desperation that you feel. So this is how Hitler creates an ecological panic. He says there's nothing in the past except struggle for land, and there's nothing in the future except struggle for land, which means we have to embark right away on some kind of radical plan to control land. Oh, and by the way, he also denies that science can change this, right?
Right.
He says that irrigation, hybridization, pesticides, all of these fertilizers, all these technologies which German scientists were actually working on in the 1930s, he says these things can't change the basic relationship between people and land. He's wrong about that, of course. They did change it. They created the world that we live in now, where we worry about obesity, as you say. But he denies science, and denying science is also part of how you create ecological panic. You create a situation in which all you can do is act drastically to try to seize land. And that's the argument Hitler makes for the war. The war is for Eastern Europe. The war is for Ukraine. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. And in making that war, in going from Germany to Ukraine, what do the German armies cover? They cover precisely the part of Europe where the vast majority of European Jews live. And so that's part of what makes a Holocaust possible.
Right. In fact, that brings us directly to the title of your book, because, of course, most people have heard of Lebensraum and the idea of living space. But very specifically, Hitler wanted that great prize where all that deep black topsoil was. And that, of course, was in the Ukraine.
That's exactly right. I mean, but black, you've decoded you've decoded the title. Black Earth is a direct reference to Ukraine. And Hitler's Lebensraum was both an idea and a geography. I mean, the geography was we have to conquer specifically Ukraine, because that's the richest bit of soil in Europe. That's what's going to transform our economy. That's what's going to make us independent. It's going to transform us into a great power. It will allow us to take our rightful place alongside the British and the Americans as one of the great powers in the world. But Lebensraum also, interestingly, is an idea. And it helps us to see how the Germans in the 30s, and unfortunately even Hitler himself, are not quite as distant from our own politics as we might perhaps like. Lebensraum means, on the one hand, you have to go and kill people far away. You have to starve inferior races and take their land. It means habitat. You have to treat other people like animals and take their habitat. You have to be ruthless, because that's the law of nature. On the other hand, Lebensraum has a second meaning. It also means comfort. It means something like living room, like our living room, like the place where you feel at home. It means a big dinner. It means the slippers by the fire, all that kind of thing.
Gemütlichkeit.
Yeah, Gemütlichkeit.
I've never heard anyone compare those two terms before.
Yeah, it's true. And so what Hitler is saying, what he's doing is he's arousing what we might think of as survivalist emotions, saying everything's a catastrophe, we have to act now. But at the same time, he's appealing not only to life, he's appealing to lifestyle. He's saying that if Germans want to have the highest standard of living in the world, and he says this explicitly, then we have to conquer more territory and starve other people. So he's mobilizing, you know, basic emotions about life, but he's also speaking to the very human or the very political or the very social desire to live better or as well as everyone else.
Indeed, and of course that brings us into the modern day. Such arguments are currently made, and I see already several very clear parallels that you mentioned science, and of course there's huge issues with global warming and climate change now. Destruction of states, what happens? Well, we're seeing that in Syria, aren't we? Are those the sorts of lessons we learn, that these sorts of things are going on today, or that we've got to watch out for them today?
Exactly. I mean, I think if you take the Holocaust and you just turn the lens a little bit, right, just turn the lens of the telescope or the kaleidoscope a little bit from what we're used to, then a lot of things in the present come into focus. I think it's very important that if we agree that the Holocaust was important, you know, perhaps the most important event of the last century, then we don't treat it just as a matter of memory, commemoration, identity politics, but we think about it as something real, something which happened and therefore which shows what can happen. And you're right. Once you get your mind around the fundamental causes, then a lot of things come clear that maybe seem like isolated events. Destroying the state, for example, as you say, the crisis in Syria happens in part because we destroy the Iraqi state and don't have something to substitute for it. So therefore, you get a kind of terrorism in Iraq you wouldn't have otherwise. Also, therefore, you get 1.5 million Iraqi refugees in Syrian cities, which is one of the causes of the Syrian civil war. In Syria, you also have 4 uninterrupted years of famine, which is so awful that scientists agree that it probably is a result of global warming, which drives a further 2 million Syrian farmers to the overpopulated cities, which brings on the civil war, which leads us to where we are today. Now, of course, there are always going to be other mediating things. There will be local particularities. There will always be a story about an evil leader, and that story will always be true. But the underlying factors, the state destruction and the ecological panic, are things that unfortunately are with us still. But fortunately, there are also things that we can get a handle on. If we see them as factors, if we try to have a policy which is a policy of foresight rather than a policy of reaction, we can make these things less likely in the future.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Tim Snyder of Yale University for telling us all about that sad but fascinating thesis of his and about the Holocaust. A very interesting new look at that subject. Thanks also to my buddy David O. Stewart for telling us about his novel, The Wilson Deception. Both these books are on Amazon. They're in your local bookstore, so run out and buy some copies and stuff some stockings. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.